All rise, please. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Idaho is now in session for service of the law.
Thank you all. Be seated, please.
Good morning. Welcome to the Idaho Supreme Court sitting in the United States Courthouse in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho for our second hearing on September 18, 2024, Mitchell versus Randall. Nicholas Randall appeals this matter, represented by Kevin Waite, and the respondent is Amanda Mitchell, represented by Samantha Hammond. Counsel, do either of you have any preliminary matters for the court today?
No, Your Honor. Yeah.
Very well then, sir, you may proceed.
Thank you.
Morning, Your Honors. I do wish to mention that Mr. Nicholas Ramlow is present in court. He's been present for probably every proceeding in this case. Mr. Ramlow had a civil protection order entered against him November 18, 2020. This was not an adjudication on the merits. It was because he was deemed not to have appeared. The record reflects that he did appear up to the courthouse door, however. He was stopped and prevented from entry by courthouse personnel. At that time, the COVID-19 virus was in full bloom, and there was a requirement to wear a mask to enter the courthouse and to wear a mask in court. Mr. Ramlow refused to wear a mask. So he was not allowed in. The protection order was then entered against him. There was an appeal to the district court that raised several issues for purposes of today's hearing, which focuses on mootness. I don't think it's really necessary to go into it. I've mentioned them in our opening brief, but they can be grouped into due process issues, statutory construction issues, and issues regarding abuse of discretion. The protection order continued in place. It was a one-year protection order as initially entered. Shortly before it expired, the appellee, Ms. Mitchell, filed to extend the protection order. There was an objection from Mr. Ramlow in a hearing, and the protection order was extended to April 17, 2022. Meanwhile, the parties briefed the appeal to the district court, and when the extended protection order then came up for its new expiration date, Ms. Mitchell that time did not file a request to further extend it. It therefore expired, I think I mentioned April 17, 2022 was that date. The oral argument before the district court, Judge Wayman, was on June 13, 2022, approximately 2 months later, and it was there that the question of mootness was raised. Judge Wayman concluded that expiration of the protection order made the appeal moot, and this appeal is from that decision by Judge Wayman. There are many cases, both in Idaho before the U.S. Supreme Court, that discussed mootness, and the standard is phrased variously, but when issues that are presented are no longer live or the parties lack a legally cognizable interest in the outcome, Idaho Schools for Equal Education Opportunity versus Idaho State Board of Education, 128 Idaho 276. Sometimes it's phrased as it's moot when there's no justiciable controversy and a judicial determination would have no practical effect on the outcome. Or if granted, no effect directly or collaterally would occur to the party seeking the relief. There are some cases where this all seems very concrete and some where it seems somewhat nebulous in terms of what the underlying facts are as you read the cases. And I think to determine whether, to analyze whether an issue is still live or there's still a legally cognizable interest or a practical effect that would be achieved, you really have to step back and as a benchmark look at, okay, what would happen if this underlying protection order had not expired? Well, the argument, of course, would have occurred to the district court. District court would decide that issue, and if the appellant, in this case Mr. Ramlow, prevailed on one or more of his issues, likely outcome of that would be a remand to the magistrate to conduct that hearing. At a hearing on the merits that resulted from that scenario, Mr. Ramlow would be able to attempt what he tried to attempt in November of 2020, to succeed in his defense and to obtain dismissal of the protection order on the merits. And that's what he still wants to do. The is contested on the merits, if he's allowed to do so. As I say, it was never adjudicated on the merits. His side of the story was never heard. If the protection order, even if the protection order has expired, there are some provisions which it's arguable as to whether they still have effect. He was ordered to complete the magistrate court's 52-week domestic violence review class, and he was ordered to get an evaluation. The question is whether that expired with the underlying order. When he didn't do those things for reasons that I don't think it's really necessary to go into here for the purpose of this case.
Counsel, just so I'm clear, I'm a little confused when you say contest on the merits.
Mm-hmm.
Contest on the merits of what? On the merits of the fact that it was deemed a failure to appear, contested on the grounds that it was okay to put a tracking device on the respondent's vehicle. I'm not sure what merits you're talking about he needed to have right to contest.
The merits of the allegations that were made against him in the original application for the protection order.
So we're talking about the claim then that there was a tracking device placed on the vehicle.
That's
one
of
them. And there was a phone that had tracking capacity.
Correct.
That's what he wants to contest.
That's what he wants to contest.
So if there was a new proceeding, then he would be making the argument he was justified in doing those things, or that he did not do those things.
He would be making the argument that he was justified in doing some things. He might be making the argument that he didn't do everything that he was accused of doing.
Okay, that's helpful. Thank you.
Okay. There are exceptions to the idea that a case is moot, or the determination that a case is moot. There are still some exceptions to that. When there's a possibility of collateral legal consequences that are imposed on the person raising the issue, or when the challenged conduct is likely to evade judicial review and is capable of repetition, or third, when an otherwise moot issue raises concerns of substantial public interest.
So following up a little bit on Justice Mueller's question, so what does the, if we were to remand the case, what does the opinion from the district court look like?
Well, hopefully, from Mr. Ramlow's point of view, it looks like a dismissal of the underlying protection order application on its merits. I think if it were to go the other way, though, he's already, I guess you could say, served his time.
Hold on, I need to follow up on that. Okay, so let's play this out. So when the district court was sitting in an appellate capacity, so we're going to send it back to the magistrate. We're going to remand it to the district court with instructions to remand it to the magistrate court to have an evidentiary hearing on the propriety of a protection order that has now expired.
Yes.
And then the order from the magistrate court, assuming that the magistrate court says that agrees with your client that there was no basis for the protection order, the magistrate court is going to do what? Enter an order saying
that, what? Well, I think that the magistrate court is going to enter an order saying that the application for the protection order is denied for perhaps insufficient evidence after hearing all of the evidence. Now, that's if the case does go back to the magistrate from, I think it probably does have to go back to the district court first to hear the issues that were raised in the appeal to the district court, which involves the refusal to wear a mask and the issues that that raises in terms of what the magistrate ruled, and the due process issues, for example, that were raised to the district court. Whether it goes back to the magistrate, I think I was focusing on, you know, what are the ultimate consequences, the ultimate relief he seeks, but certainly there's the intermediate stage of I think, having to go back to the district court.
But for a mootness analysis, don't we need to look at the ultimate relief that your client wants? Because as I see it, what your client wants is a piece of paper from the magistrate court that says the protection order should never have issued.
That's correct. He wants it dismissed. Right now, there's an order that was entered against him, in effect saying that he committed domestic violence. And I guess you could call that part of a person's civil record. It's obviously not a criminal record, but I think people somewhat look at it that way. There are collateral consequences, too, in terms of a protection order that is entered against a person, a civil protection order. Despite the protections that are made in terms of confidentiality in the court system, people who know about this can discover it through other civil litigation. Spouses, other parents, etc., use that against the person. There are certainly collateral consequences of that sort that happen frequently when these things are entered. So
I don't disagree with what you're saying about the collateral consequences from these types of orders. What I'm thinking about is the court's ability to roll back the clock and change the outcome here, because I mean that order is always going to exist. Always. I mean, it's not going to go away. I mean, and what you might be able to get is a piece of paper that says the case is dismissed, but it's never going to undo that order.
That probably makes it analogous to expungement. Somebody whose criminal conviction is expunged, for example, it's gone away in a sense.
And you don't have expungement in this state?
Well, not formally, but there have been expungement decisions here. People do apply for that and sometimes get expungement.
They might get a record sealed. They don't get a record expunged.
I beg to differ in terms of what's actually happened. I realize that it presents a procedural obstacle when somebody applies for this, and it's been a long time since I've done that, but I know that in the past I have applied for expungement for clients and once in a while gotten it, sometimes been turned down on exactly the reason that you say, Justice Brody. It depends in terms of what actually happens in those motions. But the idea is, it's like that. Or suppose you have somebody who is convicted, and then, as happens sometimes these days, DNA exonerates the person years later. I guess you could say that original conviction is still there as part of the paper record, even though it's now been dismissed. I think that in a sense, there is an ability to roll back the clock here and take a look on the merits when that was not done before. And that's what he's asking to do, is to be able to do that.
If I may, Mr. Wade, let me come forward in time just a bit in terms of the questions about remand. And let me ask your view on whether the district judge considered the exceptions to mootness. There appears to be about a one-sentence remark in the order that says the exceptions don't apply. So my question is, did the district court consider those exceptions and make a very conclusory statement, or not consider them and just move on from there.
They were briefed to the district court in supplemental briefing on the issue of mootness. So they were there for the district court to consider. I don't know the answer to your question in terms of the extent to which the district court considered those issues. It is very conclusory in the district court's opinion that simply the exceptions do not apply. That's about all it says. I'd agree with that.
So in terms of sending it back to the district court to finish out the appeal, in other words, the appeal on the merits, do you have any concerns about that analysis?
The exceptions analysis?
Yes.
I think this situation supplies exceptions, supplies the factual basis for really each of those exceptions, so that if the matter were remanded to the district court, that would certainly be one possible road that this case follows from here, depending on your decision. But it certainly is capable of repetition and evading review. It's what exactly happened here, that the order expired before the appeal process was completed. These parties have a child together. They have interaction together. There conceivably could be another protection order. It too could run its course for a while, but before it gets to the point of a meaningful appellate decision, it expires one way or the other. It's certainly capable of repetition and evading review.
Each protection order, it seems to me, is very fact-driven. And so, the fact that a protection order issues in one instance, but we can't necessarily infer from that particular scenario is going to repeat itself, right?
Well, I don't think it has to be that particular scenario. It doesn't have to factually repeat itself in lockstep, but there are people whose relationships, whether you want to call it dysfunctional, whether you want to call it highly contentious, whatever label you might use to describe it, they're repeatedly in court, whether it's on modifications of custody orders, whether it's on protection orders, whether it's something else. And it's more the mindset that potentially repeats itself. Perhaps the conduct of the party, underlying conduct that leads to this, but it's the idea that they could have another protection order entered, and simply it's impossible to get review because the matter expires before the decision is made. I don't think that's really any different from the abortion cases and the time analysis that is made in the context of those cases, which are the classic examples of matters that are capable of repetition but evading review, the abortion statutes and those cases. I think collateral consequences we've already mentioned, but also there's the issue of substantial public interest here. What you have in this kind of situation...
Before we get to that, and I'm going to set aside the collateral legal consequences one, but as far as likely to evade judicial review, I'm coming back to my initial question. Mm-hmm. What is it really that's evading review? The question of whether or not he can put a tracking device on her car, or the question of whether or not the court's interpretation of our COVID order was correct? Because if it's the latter, that order is no longer in effect. There's currently not a pandemic been declared in this country or in this state. If there's a future one, it's not guaranteed that a new order issued possibly by this court would look exactly like the last one. So if we're focused on the grounds for denying the appeal, what about that decision? I get the impression that's really what you want the court to review.
Well, it is it is that decision, too, and whether it was proper to deny him access to a hearing.
But isn't that clearly moot?
No, I think it's not clearly moot. One, it's not clear that we're done with the pandemic. You hear medical pronouncements frequently these days about variants and how people should get their COVID boosters and that sort of thing, and people coming down with COVID still. It's not the same situation.
Our order is no longer in effect. So I know the future challenge would be based on a hypothetical future order.
It's really not a future challenge so much as it is the existing challenge to that order and whether the magistrate's decision, as reviewed by the district court in this context.
But that order is gone. And given what we've learned, it's unlikely to come back in that exact same form again.
Okay, in which case it would be proper, if it's proper to bypass the issue because the order's gone, the COVID restriction order is gone, then that, I think, augurs in sending it back, in terms of sending it back to the magistrate. The order's gone. The appellant should be allowed to address this on the merits before the magistrate.
Let me clarify. The intermediate appeal, the argument on intermediate appeal was the entry of this order violated due process because he was precluded from attending the hearing because he would not put on a mask. That is the issue.
Correct.
On intermediate appeal.
Yes, that was one of the issues on intermediate appeal. That's kind of, in a sense, that captures all of them together, I think. Mm-hmm. Moving to the issue of substantial public interest, I think what's happened here is that one party has the ability to control the appeal process, to manipulate that process, and end it by simply not further extending the protection order.
Well, Mr. Wade, you wouldn't expect Ms. Mitchell to have reapplied for a protection order if she didn't feel she needed one, would you?
I don't know. It's that's hard for me to judge because the argument against it typically is she doesn't need it, we did the first time around, we opposed the extension. I can't say that just because somebody applies for it, she needs it, or she feels she needs it. I don't know what's in her mind.
Well, certainly, and I understand that. But you seem to be laying some blame at Ms. Mitchell's feet for not having moved to extend the protection order again, as if that is ipso facto manipulative and made the appeal moot.
Am I
reading that correctly?
I think that that's certainly the practical effect, is that somebody has the ability to make that analysis at that stage and say, I'm better off just letting this protection order die rather than taking my chances as to how the decision on appeal is going to come out. I'd rather get rid of the appeal by letting the protection order expire, or alternatively, in some cases, dismissing the matter, such as in the Atchison Hotels versus Laufer case in front of the U.S. Supreme Court a year ago.
Where is the substantial public interest in that? These kind of protection orders are highly fact-sensitive. They involve intimate relationships that are different in every instance. What about the unique situation here where one party decides not to extend the order further that creates a substantial public interest?
Because it's deprived the other party of any opportunity in this context to have the matter heard on the merits. And he's left with this protection order in place. It's very similar to the situation that's addressed in the U.S. Supreme Court case of United States versus Munsingware, the State versus Barkley case in Idaho, where if the appeal is moot, the underlying order is also dismissed because it's unfair to deprive that person of the opportunity to seek reversal, to seek vacating of the order.
But the extension of a protection order is typically not about the adjudication of the original cause for the extension order. It's about whether the situation at the time of the extension request requires the order to be extended. It's not dealing with the underlying cause of the original suspension. It's dealing with the current, the status quo, not the past situation. So I'm just confused as to why that's a decision that there's a substantial public interest, because it's going to be different in every single case.
Well, I think every protection order situation, the fact situation, is going to be different in every single case.
And whether it should be extended or not is going to be different in every case.
It is going to be theoretically different in every single case. I think, with all due respect to Justice Mueller, you're implying that there's more review and analysis in those extension hearings than, in fact, there typically is. They frequently do not get a lot of attention.
Honest, I don't imply anything. What I'm saying is a year and a half or so after the original protection order was issued, the judge is going to say, is everything fine now? And if both parties say, yeah, we can let the protection order die, they let it die. And the only time there's a full adjudication on an extension is if one party wants it to remain in effect and the other doesn't.
Well, I guess my point is, one, if both parties came in, and one of them said, yeah, I applied for an extension a week or two ago. I've now reconsidered and I don't want it anymore. And they both agreed to let it drop. Of course, the judge would dismiss it. That's no different from coming in on the initial hearing of a temporary protection order. But what I was responding to earlier is the idea that these extension hearings are somehow a full-blown hearing, typically with a thorough analysis of what is going on now. Frequently, there's no real new evidence, especially if the person against whom the order was entered has abided by the order. There's no improper conduct or anything like that. And sometimes, despite that kind of evidence, the view is more, this was viewed as serious enough when it was entered a year ago, we're going to continue it at the request of the person, or this person is still afraid and concerned, and that's about all the evidence amounts to. And frequently that's enough to get the extension order. So I just don't think that the view that those extension orders are very thorough is something that accords with reality. So I think it is something of public interest to keep the process on a level playing field, to allow somebody the opportunity to contest the underlying allegations when he was never allowed to in the first place. Here it was because he didn't wear a mask at that time. There's no mask requirement at this time, so yeah, that's not an impediment anymore, and presumably the hearing on what he did and whether that and why and whether that qualified for a protection order could be heard without that kind of obstacle at this point. And so it could be remanded. Whether it has to go through the district court first, that may be necessary. But ultimately, it could go back to the magistrate for a decision. Alternatively, if the matter is considered moot and no exceptions apply, the interest of justice would be that the underlying protection order should be dismissed as well, consistent with Munsingware, Atchison Hotels, and the Barclay case.
Are there any actual legal consequences to your client that have been identified? What I'm talking about is, for example, in some instances, a civil protection order can result in somebody not being able to possess a gun, have a concealed weapons permit, any type of consequence like that, or are we talking really this case is about what I'll call reputational injury to your client?
Well, certainly reputational injury to him. At the time that the protection order was in effect, of course, it would have prohibited him from possessing any firearms. That restriction goes away when the protection order goes away. So it's not that element is not anything current. The only thing I'm aware of is and there's been some discussion in the briefing, is that in the custody case that exists between the parties over their son, there is a provision that resulted from a stipulation at the time, back when the protection order was still in effect, that moving from stage one to stage two of that custody order required completing the 52-week course. Now, obviously, he wouldn't have agreed to that if it hadn't been in place already from another order.
Where is that in the record?
I think we put the judgment in the record from that case.
And the judgment is there. My question is, where is it in the record that he would not have agreed to that before the condition in the protection order?
Probably not explicitly. That's more of a matter of logic in terms of people's behavior. I think it's fair to say he simply would not have agreed to it if it were brought up out of thin air. And it wouldn't have been possible either if he wasn't under some kind of order to do it. If you're not under they don't just let people come in to to that program because somebody in the other side in the case says that they ought to do it. You would have to be ordered in a criminal or civil protection case in order to be able to do that.
I just didn't see any of that in the record. So I can appreciate that may be your experience with the program, but in terms of my decision-making, I looked at that stipulation and I thought, he wants to see his son. He wants to move forward to phase two. Sure, if that's what I need to do, it's not a hill I'm willing to die on, fine, I'll go to the class. That was my reading of it.
Sure. And I think it's doubtful whether he would be able to go to the class now that he's no longer under an order that comes out of cases where people are ordered to come to the class. I don't think in a civil case you can actually do it just because it says in the order. You have to be ordered to do it in a criminal case or a protection order case.
And I just wanted to know if there was somewhere in the record that evidences that, and it sounds like there's not.
I don't believe there is.
Thank you, sir. Your time is completed.
Thank you.
Ms. Hammond, when you're ready.
Thank you, Justices. Are you ready for me to check?
You may proceed.
Thank you. My name is Samantha Hammond. I work for the law firm of Palmer George, and I represent appellee Amanda Mitchell, who is present today.
Ms. Hammond, I'm having a hard time hearing you.
I'm sorry. I have a very soft voice, so I'll try to speak into the microphone. I apologize. I will try to keep this brief, as I believe most of the pertinent arguments are contained in the appellee's brief that has been filed with the court. But, of course, I'm here to answer any questions as well. Mr. Ramlo's briefing, as well as mine, does specifically state that really the sole issue on appeal is whether the expiration of the civil protection order renders this case moot, or the appeal moot that was brought before the district court. I believe both of the briefs are fairly accurate in terms of the procedural history. Ms. Mitchell, in November of 2020, I'm a little nervous, so my voice shakes a little bit. In November 2020, did file for a protection order. At the time, she had a different counsel who was unable to make it to the initial protection order hearing. And Mr. Ramlo did not appear at that because he was refused to wear a mask in the courthouse. Ms. Mitchell did ask for a continuance at that time in order to secure counsel, and the court did continue the matter for approximately 2 weeks, and I believe it was November 18th in which the court rescinded the hearing. I did represent Ms. Mitchell at that initial hearing that did come before the court, and Mr. Waite was also there to represent Mr. Ramlo. As part of the main issue that was the underlying appeal is whether Mr. Ramlo was denied his constitutional rights to due process for not being allowed into the courthouse for failure to wear a mask, which was mandated by the Supreme Court at that time. However, the facts of this case are very intricate, and there are a lot of different moving parts, and I have tried to brief that the best I could, but essentially, at the time, there were underlying criminal charges that stemmed from the same allegations that were part of this protection order, which were for stalking. And Mr. Ramlow was outside the courthouse, I believe. I never saw him, but that is what Mr. Waite has stated in his briefing, that he had had a conversation with Mr. Ramlow prior to the hearing, and that he did speak with him, and he was denied entry into the courthouse at that time for a failure to wear a mask or refusal to wear a mask. However, at the time that the hearing commenced, the judge had asked where Mr. Ramlow was, and we took up our matter first over the other cases that were scheduled at the same time. And Mr. Ramlow was apparently outside the courthouse, but the judge did ask the bailiffs to retrieve him with or without a mask, and that's quoted in my brief, because that was exactly what the court had said, with or without a mask. And the bailiffs are ordered to take him into custody if he refuses to come in because he has an outstanding warrant for his arrest. The bailiffs did exit the courthouse to find Mr. Ramlow, and they were not able to locate him. I, at the time, did inform the court that we believed he had been arrested on his outstanding warrant in that small time frame because there was police activity outside. And that was later confirmed that is what happened, is he had been arrested at that time. But ultimately, what Mr. Ramlow argues today, as well as in his underlying brief, or his underlying appeal, is that he was denied due process and that he should be allowed to have this matter remanded, first, obviously, to the district court and then to the magistrate court, and ultimately that he should be able to have a hearing on the merits. The problem that we see with that is he had the opportunity to have the original protection order, the original application for the protection order, to present his whatever argument he wanted to present. He had the opportunity to cross-examine Ms. Mitchell and if she had witnesses, but he chose not to appear. It was, and I'm certainly not going to get into any of whether his beliefs are correct or not, but he chose not to appear because he did not want to wear a mask. And it was difficult for everybody during that time to wear a mask, but it was just what we had to do at the time. And he had that opportunity, but he chose not to. Again,
counsel, help me understand. You say he chose not to. In your brief at page 3, you say that he wasn't present because he was arrested.
That's true, Your Honor.
Which sounds like that he was absent not by his own choice, but by the fact that he was under arrest by the state.
I think it was certainly a two-part because initially he refused to enter or was denied entry. And then the second part was then in between that time being denied entry. And then.
So was he arrested because he refused to wear a mask, or was he arrested because there was a complaint, criminal warrant for stalking, for putting a tracking device on a vehicle, for draining oil from the client's vehicle? Is that why he was arrested, or was he arrested because he entered the courthouse without a mask?
No, he was arrested on that criminal matter. Not because of failure to. I personally don't know. I can't speak to it. I never thought anybody get arrested for failure to wear a mask. They were just simply denied entry. That's my understanding. But I could be wrong. I don't know what happened.
And I want to step back a little bit, Ms. Hammond. You're arguing the merits of the intermediate appeal, and I don't know that procedurally we can get there. Are you saying we should just decide the intermediate appeal, and if so, what's our basis?
No, Your Honor. I think that the court should affirm that this matter is moot. And I'm sorry, I was probably talking a little too much about. I guess what I was trying to aim at is some of the court's prior questions to counsel. Ultimately, if what Mr. Ramlow is asking is that this be remanded and that he have the opportunity to present his side to the original protection order, and ultimately, I was just stating it, he did have that opportunity, so I believe the case is moot at this point in time, which I can certainly focus on that. I apologize.
No, I just wanted to make sure I was understanding your argument, and if you were asking or saying, you guys go ahead and decide, us go ahead and decide the intermediate appeal. And I thought, I don't know that we can do that. I think we have to focus on the mootness. So now I understand.
Okay.
Thank you.
But yes, so ultimately, and I did just want to point out that Ms. Mitchell did renew the protection order, I believe, while the appeal was pending, the original appeal to the district court. And at that time, Mr. Ramwell did have the opportunity again to argue against the renewal. But again, he did not appear at that hearing, and the court did grant it. And it was a contested hearing where counsel did question Ms. Mitchell and was able to cross-examine her, and then the court did renew it. But ultimately, once this matter was brought to the district court, as has been briefed, and Mr. Waite has also addressed, during that time it had been appealed. We went in front of Judge Wayne in the district court and argued about the underlying appeal at that time. But at the time of oral argument, the civil protection order had expired, and Ms. Mitchell did not choose to renew it, which is fully within her right to do. One of the things that, I guess, focusing on the mootness issue is this case, it is moot when there's no practical effect upon the outcome. And then, of course, as Mr. Wheat talked about, as well as the briefing, there are three exceptions to that have been outlined by the state or by the Supreme Court. One is whether there's a possibility of the collateral legal consequences. And I know in Mr. Ramlo's briefing, he does talk about different collateral consequences that may have occurred based off of the original protection order. But the original protection order, as well as the one that was subsequently renewed, have expired, and Ms. Mitchell has chosen not to renew those.
So some of those collateral consequences continue? Justice Brody used the phrase reputational injury. Certainly, the fact that the order has expired doesn't necessarily remove the reputational injury, does it?
Not necessarily. However, the civil protection order cases are typically sealed. And so generally, no one would even know that one existed, except for the fact that it's been appealed. And now I believe it's unsealed on the iCourt portal. But otherwise, no one would even know about it, unless Mr. Ramlow is out informing people about it. Of course, Ms. Mitchell would likely have to inform law enforcement or schools or anyone to make sure that she's protected in case of a violation of that. But other than that, it is a sealed case. And I don't, that I cannot pinpoint any other collateral consequences that have occurred based off of an expiration of a civil protection order.
Can you speak to Mr. Waite's argument that it could affect or be brought up in future child custody?
Certainly. I think I did address that a little bit in my briefing, but ultimately the protection order, I believe, was in place at the time that the parties stipulated to their custody agreement. So that was in April of 2021, and the protection order was still in place at that time. So they have had a judgment since 2021, and I did address it, but according to the family law rules, I think it's 201, in order for Ms. Mitchell to modify her custody, she does have to show that there are substantial material and permanent changes in circumstances. And stating that there was a protection order that had existed at the time that the parties had entered into their stipulated judgment, but has since expired, it's not detrimental to Mr. Ramlow. It's actually beneficial to him to be able to say, yes, there was one at that time, but now it's expired or hasn't been renewed. And so those circumstances no longer exist.
And I understand that. I was thinking more in terms of if there's a different substantial material change in circumstances that gives rise to a petition to modify custody, would that protection order, could it play a part in the court's decision if it finds, yes, substantial material change and it reallocates custody, could it take that order into account in deciding how to reallocate custody?
I can't speak for certain, but each judge typically will rule differently. I've had judges say, you know, that existed prior to the existing judgment, and I'm only looking at evidence that has occurred after that, and so therefore they may not consider it. However, they may consider it. So yes, technically they could say there was a protection order and take that into account because of, you know, past behavior and whether they should modify the custody agreement or order going forward. So yes.
What about a future custody proceeding or adoption proceeding involving a different party? Now, granted, you just explained to me that it's sealed, but certainly your client could be called as a witness in one of those proceedings and say, yeah, I got a protection order against him. He did this and this and this. And unless he can say that order got overturned by the court, that's likely going to carry some weight in a guardianship proceeding or any kind of proceeding involving children.
And just so I understand the question, are you asking if there were, say, another child of Mr. Ramlow?
Let's say he gets married to someone else and they have a child. Certainly the new wife in the new case, if she talks with your client, likely would call her as a witness.
Certainly. And I agree with that. That would be something that could affect him in the future. And ultimately, this case is very intricate, and there's a lot of different moving parts to it. But agreed, that is something that could happen. You know, they could call Ms. Mitchell as a witness. And ultimately, at this point in time, she can say, well, you know, I didn't renew it. But if it were remanded again and dismissed, then yes, that could help Mr. Ramlow to be able to say, you know, I was able to have it dismissed on the merits. But because it just makes it more difficult because it is a civil protection order. It's not a criminal no contact order where the state is the one pursuing it. It's ultimately up to Ms. Mitchell as the petitioner, or in any civil protection order, the petitioner is the one who has to bring forward the application for a protection order to be in place, and ultimately it would also be her decision whether she wanted to ask the court to renew it or even dismiss it on her own. And so I don't know if that made sense.
I guess you could argue that the results of the underlying criminal warrant for which he was arrested would likely be much more serious than the protection order proceeding?
Yes, and there was a no contact order, I believe two no contact orders during the existence of the civil protection order, and then with the criminal cases, they did get resolved through mediation, and then the no contact orders were extended for an additional year, which I believe expired approximately a year after the civil protection order.
So criminal cases didn't result in a finding of guilt?
They did. It was a mediated agreement. I can't recall exactly, but I think he
pled to something.
He pled to one, yes. Like, there are three counts, and I believe he pled to one, two different cases. So yes, but ultimately, and I don't believe that's been appealed, but ultimately she could refer to the criminal no contact orders as well as the criminal adjudication.
So. Does our exceptions to the mootness doctrine, is there any room in those exceptions to look at the merits of the intermediate appeal here? And I guess what I'm really after is do we ever consider whether the person seeking to overcome the mootness doctrine is likely to succeed on appeal?
On the underlying merits? Or
no, not on the merits, but on the appeal. The appeal is that, you know, he was deprived of due process. And so, I mean, do we look at whether he's likely to succeed on that as to whether we should...
I think... I don't know any case law off the top of my head. I think looking at the exceptions would be the best analysis of whether one of those exceptions apply. And of course, our argument is none of those exceptions apply. There's no collateral collateral consequences. The one thing that I focus on a little bit is whether the challenged conduct is likely to evade judicial review. And I do understand a portion of that. But ultimately, and I think this is in my brief, because protection orders, most of them, are only extended for up to a year originally, unless the court does agree to renew it, ultimately, I think in a civil protection order context, this could repeat where they expire prior to an appeal being heard. I agree that that could happen because in the nature of them, they are limited. But that's just not the circumstances in this case. And the court should not issue an advisory opinion because that's not what happened in this case. Ms. Mitchell, and I guess the argument from Mr. Ramlow is that Ms. Mitchell somehow strategically let it expire in order to avoid an appellate decision on the merits of the case. And there's just so much more to the actual facts, which is there was a no-contact order in place, a criminal no-contact order in place, so she was already protected for an additional year after the civil protection order expired. And with the argument about the 52-week batterer's intervention course, that was also issued in the custody case. So ultimately, she had all the protections, and I don't think that this particular case is an issue where we can address what the underlying issues were, because it was moot at the time, and she chose to let it expire. And there were a lot of different moving parts to this, primarily his refusal to wear a mask and being denied due process. If this, hypothetically, if this were remanded, and Ms. Mitchell, first, it would be very strange for her to go back before the court and have a hearing on the merits, the underlying protection order, because within the statute, most of these things have to have occurred within the previous 6 months, and if it had been remanded, so she would be in an entirely different situation. But there's just seeking the relief that he is asking for is not going to get the same result that he is seeking, because she ultimately doesn't have to even pursue a protection order at that point in time.
Are there mechanisms, and I'm talking now outside of this case and looking at our system as a whole, are there mechanisms that for people to appeal these kinds of decisions in a timely manner? Do we have motions to expedite appeals, things like that? I mean, or do we really have a system that doesn't provide meaningful review?
Well, I can't recall off the top of my head, which I think is an appellate rule, but obviously, like terminations of parental rights, adoption, and other matters of that sort can seek expedited appeal. Whereas I think that with that mechanism in place, because especially in this particular case where the minor child was protected under the civil protection order, I would say that someone in that position who chooses to appeal could certainly ask for an expedited review and to have it be appealed directly to the Supreme Court rather than have an intermediate appeal. So I think that there are mechanisms in place. They just have to be utilized. And ultimately, the appellate process is not always speedy, but appealing to the district court did get him certain appellate review earlier than obviously appealing a second time to the Supreme Court. But I don't know if that answers your question, but I think that there are mechanisms in place to help because the protection orders do, like I said, they do expire much sooner than other judgments do. I did just want to address the first question is regarding the 52-week domestic violence requirement. That is something that Mr. Ramlow agreed to. Whether that was a basis because of the civil protection order or not, I don't know. I don't know if that was ever discussed, but ultimately, it's something he agreed to do. And Mr. Ramlo seems to argue that that is a collateral consequence of the civil protection order and that it would never have been agreed to within the custody agreement, which is really neither here nor there, but I think it does deserve mentioning that the civil protection order, once it expired, it's an expired order. It's not being enforced by anyone. And I don't believe that the court would even have jurisdiction to enforce an expired order. It's now been expired for nearly 3 years, I believe. So at least two years. So in order for somebody to enforce that, it would have had to have been Ms. Mitchell during the existence of that order, or the court asking to enforce it. Originally, the court did start enforcing it because they had set it for review hearings, and Mr. Ramlo failed to appear for that review hearing, and then there was another warrant issued. But Ms. Mitchell had never filed a motion for contempt. The court, a different magistrate, allowed Mr. Ramlo to attend those review hearings in Montana because it was easier for him to do so there. Apparently, he ran into some difficulties, but no one enforced that order. So there's no collateral contact or consequences of the civil protection order requirement that he complete the 52-week domestic violence counseling. But he agreed to it in the custody case. And he can certainly address that within the custody context. But even in that context, he still has not completed it or done so. And saying that somehow he's under this obligation or that it has some consequence to him, yet he's never been held in contempt for failing to abide by it. He's never had to address the fact that he continues to fail to do so. So saying this somehow affects him and yet he's never actually done it, really, it's a very baseless argument. And just to address, I do believe that Rule 1001 of the Idaho Family Law Rules do allow a magistrate court within a family law case to order domestic violence counseling, and that they do have the power to do so. And in my experience with the domestic violence counseling, I could be incorrect, but my experience is a court order from a magistrate court in a custody matter will allow him to attend that if he so chooses to. But but ultimately, I do believe that this matter is moot. I don't believe that Mr. Ramlo can point to any exceptions that apply to the mootness doctrine. I understand that there is an argument that this is somehow, that there could be some concerns for a substantial public interest, and I think that was an argument regarding like the masks, essentially, and understanding that we don't know what the future holds, and the court could eventually issue something similar, and he believes that that needs to be heard. I think that's just a hypothetical, speculative request, and I believe that this case is moot. He cannot point to any exceptions to the mootness doctrine or why, or get any exceptions to it, and why he continues to be impacted by an expired protection order that he did have the opportunity to defend against, in which he either chose to not appear for his refusal to wear a mask or because he was arrested. But he did have three opportunities to do so and did not. So. Do you have any more questions for me?
Appears there aren't any.
Okay.
Thank you. Of course, I believe the appellant spoke for his 30 minutes and beyond. Is that correct? Great. Thank you, Dan. This matter is now under advisement. We will render a decision accordingly and be in recess for a few minutes.
All rise, please.